Factory is entitled Liberty and Constitutional Architecture and will be moderated by Judge James Buckley. Judge Buckley was educated at Yale, both his BA and his law degree, and has been a senator from New York before being appointed to the Circuit Court for D.C. in 1985. Is that correct? Judge Buckley. Good afternoon. Good morning, Robert. Excuse me. It's good afternoon, Washington time. Our topic at this time is liberty and constitutional architecture. It implies that there is more than a passing connection between the two. Yet today, the average American equates his liberties with the Constitution's first 10 amendments and gives little, if any, thought to its architecture. The Constitution that is discussed in the Federalist Papers, of course, had yet to be amended, and however majestic an affirmation of fundamental values, the Bill of Rights was nonetheless a constitutional afterthought, although the promise of one proved critical to its ratification. The fact is that the Constitution's authors believed that our liberties would ultimately depend on their ability to structure a government in ways that would always maintain a check on the exercise, and therefore on the abuse of power. It would never be enough in their estimation to rely on the ballot box. As James Madison put it in his endlessly quotable paper number 51, a dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control on the government, but experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. The founders' concern then was with how to frame a government that would be effective but never threatening. The grand design, the auxiliary precautions that emerged from the constitutional debates, proved a brilliant answer to the challenge that Madison posed in the following terms. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place to oblige it to control itself. The framers met that challenge in three ways. First, by dividing the powers delegated to the new government among three separate but equal branches. Second, by establishing checks and balances on the exercise of those powers, including internal checks and balances in the case of Congress. And third, by reserving to the sovereign states all authority not delegated to the national government. It was this last element of our constitutional design, the principle of federalism, that commanded the admiration of the famous British historian Lord Acton. In a turn-of-the-century lecture on the American Revolution, in which he catalogued what he believed to be the Constitution's significant failings, Lord Acton nevertheless concluded that, quote, by the development of the principle of federalism, it has produced a community more powerful, more prosperous, more intelligent, and more free than any other which the world has seen. Two centuries have now elapsed, and notwithstanding the jockeying that will occur between the legislative and executive branches to establish which is the more equal, the concept of a separation of powers and the checks and balances designed to restrain their exercise remain integral parts of our governmental system. On the other hand, the three branches of the federal government have, over the years, engaged in massive raids on the constitutional prerogatives of the states to the point where, today, there is virtually no governmental responsibility that the Supreme Court will find beyond the reach of federal authority. We need not worry about this, however, because in Garcia, the Supreme Court has assured us that the 535 members of the House and Senate, who, after all, are elected from all parts of the United States, can be counted upon to protect the interests of the states against the imperialist impulses of the 535 individuals who write our federal laws. Whatever the fate of federalism, the structure of our national government has remained essentially unchanged for more than 200 years. That does not mean, of course, that some of its halls have not been put to uses that would have astounded the original architects, with consequences that may or may not have advanced the liberties and well-being of the American people. To eliminate the grand constitutional design and its relationship to liberty, we have on hand three eminent scholars whom I will introduce in turn. Following their presentations, I will ask each of them to rebut any absurdities that may have been uttered by one or more of his co-panelists. Because we have only three panelists, they will not be held to the 12-minute that has been set as a time for original presentations. And then after their rebuttals, the audience will be invited to question, but not to lecture, the panelists. Our first speaker will be Professor John Baker of the Louisiana State Law Center. He teaches, among other subjects, courses on constitutional law. He has done Trojan work in Eastern Europe recently, undoing the damage done by gratuitous advice provided the leaders of the new nascent democracies by, among others, representatives of People for the American Way. He reports, incidentally, that the Federalist Papers are on the bestsellers lists of all of those societies. Professor Baker.
Thank you, Judge Buckford. I don't know whether you did notice in the September 16th issue of Newsweek, the day before Constitution Day, it was reported that in Moscow, the bestseller is the Federalist Papers. And there was great demand at the U.S. Information Agency for that book translated into Russian. They wanted to know how it could be possible to balance the power of the central government with some autonomy in the local republics. And that's a matter they're still obviously struggling with. Well, at the break, Professor Lino Graglia said to me, you know, it's difficult to generate controversy about the Federalist Papers. And knowing that Lino thrives on controversy, I took that to be a criticism that somehow this was not the kind of setting that he's used to. And I know that by the time he gets up at the end of this day, he will have rectified any inadequacy as far as controversy goes. But I do think that there is plenty of opportunity in this panel for controversy, and hopefully we will be able to deliver it to you. In order to find out where the controversy lies, I think we should go back to certain basics. That is, some of these things that I'm going to talk about have been touched on by other speakers, and they may well be familiar to you, but I'm going to invite you to look at them possibly in a way that you haven't looked at them before. The title, which is Constitutional Architecture and Liberty, probably sounds to be a strange one to some people. That is, the term constitutional architecture sounds like we're in an architecture school or in an engineering school, or we're going to build something. And yet, I doubt that many law students today, many law professors today, think of the Constitution that way, even if they have read the Federalist Papers. So first of all, I want to talk about why it's necessary, really, to study the Federalist Papers. Two, I want to go over some basic confusion regarding terms that we all take for granted. And three, I want to come back and connect that to liberty. First of all, what's unfamiliar? It is generally the case that if people have read anything of the Federalist Papers, they've read 10 and 51. If you read that much in a law school class, that's quite something. Normally, what is read in a law school class is an excerpt from Federalist 78, which is thought to justify judicial supremacy. The difficulty with that is that if you read the other articles on the judiciary and a few other articles, you'll find that the normal inferences drawn from that reading of Federalist 78 are quite different from the normal inferences drawn. For instance, if one would read in Federalist 84 that Hamilton is arguing that a Bill of Rights is dangerous, and then you go back and look at 78 and he says courts are there to protect individual rights, you have to ask yourself, what were they going to do without a Bill of Rights? What were they going to protect? Well, you have to begin to think structurally. Think in terms of constitutional architecture. And there are barriers to that. One of them has already been adverted to, and that is the overriding orientation that we have regarding rights, and that is the focus on which most people in this country have been educated to look at the protection of liberty. But the other part has to do with lawyering itself. In the prior panel, Dean Choper said that he doubted that the Federalists would have expected that later generations would parse their words. I would agree with part of that. They would have doubted we would have parsed the words. They expected that we would read the words. Lawyers parse words. Lawyers tend to read a constitution the way they read a contract. Narrow it to the terminology that you can control. This specifically goes against the readings, the way the Marshall Court read things, the idea of structural interpretation as discussed in McCullough, which is lifted out of the Federalist Papers, which is further then explained in Story's understanding of how to interpret a constitution. The third area in which we are unfamiliar is the idea of rhetorical argument. Now, it's true that we argue a lot in law school and we supposedly engage in the Socratic dialogue, but the idea of rhetoric as classically understood is largely lost. In the first panel, there was reference to theories of government focusing on the Federalists. And then there was the counter that this is advocacy. First of all, the idea of separation of theory and advocacy is inconsistent with the idea of rhetorical argument. The founders, those who wrote the Federalist Papers, are not theoreticians. They are not philosophers. They are philosophic men. They are well-educated people who are, yes, eclectic because they are well-educated. What they set out to give us is not a theory of government, because what they had before them did not correspond to the plan either of Madison or the plan of Hamilton. They are there to explain what they have. So the Federalist Papers is important not merely as a theory of government, it is an explanation of what it is and how it will work. Now, you say, well, it hasn't worked out that way. Well, don't be so sure that it really hasn't worked out that way. First of all, you have to look at the role of the Federalist Papers. As Professor Forrest MacDonald, author of the book Novus Ordo Seclorum, says, that by the time Jacksonian democracy arrived, the structure had been so well supplanted and cemented that the pygmies that came along later could not destroy the structure, and the structure continued to operate despite all valiant attempts to change it. What happened in that early generation was the building of institutions, and that's critical to the Federalist Papers and the counter to the idea of parchment barriers. They were not only dissatisfied with the idea of a Bill of Rights because it was only on paper, they were dissatisfied with merely parchment separation of powers. They wanted the building of institutions. And of course, primary among those institutions that were built was the Supreme Court, and we know the great role of the Marshall Court there. But sometimes it is not known of the role of the Federalist Papers, because if you run a Lexis search, you will find very few citations to the Federalist Papers in the Marshall Court decisions. But if you take the language not only of Marbury and McCullough, but other cases given, and you track it against the language in the Federalist Papers, you would accuse Marshall of plagiarism. He changes a few words here and there just to make sure that it's not exactly the same. But Story comes along and takes the Marshall decisions and puts them into his explanation, his commentaries on the Constitution. And one of his purposes is to cement the Federalist Papers in our understanding of this Constitution. And that is continued not only as a basis for educating lawyers, but it becomes a constitutional catechism by which children at the high school level and even down at the grade school level learn their constitutional catechism at an early age. So what we're looking at is the explanation of how this government works, and if it does not work exactly the way they predicted it would work, you can normally go and find that there is some reason, some mechanism that isn't working the way it was supposed to work that will explain exactly why it's not working. Now, second point regarding redefinition of terms. As it was suggested by Judge Easterbrook, this is probably something we should have done 11 years ago. I remember the first Federalist meeting at Yale was on federalism, and there was speaker after speaker discussing the definition of federalism, and there was all kinds of confusion regarding the meaning of federalism. The fact is that there is a great deal of confusion regarding federalism, separation of powers, checks and balances, and democracy. And if you do not understand that what the Federalist Papers does is to redefine those terms so that terms match the document, then you find yourself in constitutional and analytical difficulty as you go along. First of all, if you look at any typical high school textbook, it's likely that they will not even mention the term separation of powers. They will use the term checks and balances. And as I'm going through checks and balances and federalism and democracy, I want to distinguish between those changes that were by design and those changes that were by accident or by compromise, because it's often said that after all, you can't theorize about this because it's all done by compromise. It was not all done by compromise. In the area of separation and checks and balances, it is done by design. Both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists agreed with Montesquieu that there had to be separation of powers because otherwise you would have a tyranny. But the Anti-Federalist criticism of this document was that there really was not separation of powers because, after all, the president had a veto and there was interplay from one branch to the other. The Federalists come back and not only merely explain that for advocacy purposes, but it was by design. What was the design? The design had to do with the natural predominance of the legislative branch, so that it was necessary that you build up the other two branches. And in putting in these auxiliary precautions and giving a check by the other branches against the judiciary, you have a new form of checks and balances that was different from what was previously understood. That is, if you look at Federalist 9, the reference to checks and balances is to legislative checks and balances. It refers really to bicameralism. This is a new adaptation of checks and balances, which forces the branches not only apart, but by checking, brings them back together. What it does ultimately, structurally, is to force compromise. And we've seen plenty of that in government, and it eliminates, to a large extent, the influence of the passionate faction, the ideological faction. It forces compromise through the system by bringing the branches together, even while separation of powers tends to keep them apart. Jefferson's idea of separation of powers was much more distinct than was the idea that the Federalists had. So the checks and balances and separation of powers have come to be joined together, but they are still distinct terms. And to substitute checks and balances for the term separation of powers is a great mistake, because it gives rise to what we've had since the 30s, the administrative state. The administrative state has no regard for separation of powers, but it includes plenty of checks and balances. Checks and balances by themselves will not produce the kind of public good, the kind of justice, the kind of liberty that the Federalist Papers were looking for. So it is a design as to separation of powers and checks and balances there. Regarding federalism, this is clearly by compromise. But it is a fortuitous compromise. It is one in which the states become represented in the Senate. And we've heard several people mention already that the direct popular election of senators has removed one of the basic protections states had in the original federal system. And it may be that there is no other way to check it, given that the people have decided to remove that basic check. But more fundamentally regarding federalism, it is often misconceived. And I try to get Judge Buckley here to engage in a little controversy by pushing the 10th Amendment, because the last time we were together on a panel in New Orleans, you were pushing the 10th Amendment, and you only did it obliquely today in your reference to Garcia. The idea that federalism is protected by the 10th Amendment is certainly not a position that the Federalist Papers would take. Well, you would say that obviously the 10th Amendment was not written at the time the Federalist Papers were written, so there is no conflict there. Madison, however, when he introduces the Bill of Rights to the Congress, tells them, assures them, that nothing in this document of the proposed amendments will change the structure of this Constitution. And the 10th Amendment and the question of sovereign power and where that ultimately rested was critical. And despite every attempt to read the word expressly into the 10th Amendment, it is expressly left out of the 10th Amendment, contrary to similar wording in the Articles of Confederation. The importance of this is that we do not get a confederation. Well, you say we all know that, but some things that are not always clear is that we move in the Federalists from the word confederation to federation as if they are clearly opposite terms today. They are today, they weren't back then. And if you look at Federalist 9, the two are used interchangeably. But by the time we get to Federalist 39, we have something new. And what we have come to know as federalism, the Federalists don't call federalism. They call it the compound republic. They are answering the charge that this document is not adequately federalist. And after going through the sources and the ratification in all of the aspects of this very complicated doctrine, which Judge Easterbrook has gone through in part, they explain what this thing really is. And I'm quoting from the last part of Federalist 39. The proposed Constitution, therefore, is in strictness neither a national nor a federal constitution, but a composition of both. In its foundation, it is federal, not national. In its sources from which the ordinary powers of the government are drawn, it is partly federal and partly national. In the extent of them, again, it is federal, not national. And finally, in the authoritative mode of introducing amendments, it is neither wholly federal nor wholly national. Now, this document is very complicated, and that, among other things, is what the anti-federalists did not like. It was complicated. And they distrusted people who complicated things using design, because the anti-federalists were, in large part, men of tradition and history, and they distrusted new things concocted by reason. And this thing is much the product of reason. They also redefined the term democracy, and I wish our political leaders would learn this, because what we sell abroad to other countries in the name of democracy doesn't exist in this country. We sell one man, one vote, simple majoritarianism abroad, and yet that's not what we have, and we know it's not what we have. But they were out to rescue the term democracy, which they acknowledged at the time is a bad term. How do they rescue it? They equate democracy with this new thing. And what is this new thing? It's not confederal or old federal, and it's not a national government. They were all against a purely national government or a consolidated government. This compound of extended, separated powers, representative through a complicated representation system, really had no model. And as a result of splitting sovereign powers the way they did, it creates all kinds of practical difficulties in working out not only federalism, but questions of federal jurisdiction, a matter with which the Marshall Court struggled, and courts still today are struggling. Well, my third point, how important is all of this structure to liberty? Well, it depends on several things. First of all, it depends on a view of human nature. Now, we had discussed last night the whole question of human nature, but I would like to simplify it just a little bit. The difficulty today is that in law school, certainly, you don't talk about human nature. And even if you were to take a degree in political science, unless you can find a very good political theorist, you're not likely to talk about human nature. You're likely to talk about human behavior and statistics and other scientific models that look at human beings as if they were objects of study externally only. You might also look at human nature, as Rousseau did, and think that, as many people seem to think today, the democratic man is really a very good person, and the only thing that prevents the good from coming out of democracies is all of these structures, the system that holds people back and produces bad things. If that's your view, you're not going to like structure at all. Or you might be a utopian who thinks that although human nature is not what it could be, and maybe there isn't a human nature, given the proper government, we can eventually perfect human nature. The founders engaged in none of those speculations. They accepted as a given that human beings were flawed. We heard about that last night and today, that they were both made up of emotion and reason, that the passions and the interest inclinations were very strong. It also depends on how you look at law and what its purpose is. In the law schools today, besides the rights orientation, you get the idea that it really doesn't matter what we do. What's important is the process. It's process for the sake of process. In other words, there is no end. There is no end to government. Or if there is an end, it's either merely parceling out the goods, dividing the pie, or maybe it is equality. But it certainly isn't the ends that the framers talked about. They talked about ends, which we've heard about today, this morning, from Professor Epstein, the ends of justice, the public good, and liberty. Now, ultimately, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists could at least agree that liberty could not be protected in a consolidated government. They agreed in large part on separation of powers, and that's why it wasn't litigated for many years. They disagreed on federalism, which it was anticipated would be a continuing source of disagreement because of the unique division of power between the states and the federal government. But more importantly, when it comes to liberty, they had different ideas about what government should do and what it could do regarding liberty. The Anti-Federalists wanted a small republic. They wanted a situation in which people could know one another, they could know their representatives, they were fairly equal, they would work hard, they would develop virtue, and only in the virtuous society they thought, and therefore at the local level in the small republic, could you have effective self-government. The Federalists, on the other hand, had a very different view of this. They thought that those small republics could be very oppressive. And they also thought that in order to protect liberty, you needed an energetic government for two purposes: to protect against the internal dangers of faction and the external danger of foreign aggression. But they tell us in Federalist 9 that it is possible, Montesquieu tells us, to combine both the advantages of a small republic and the advantages of a monarchy, which is strength, in what they are about to explain to us. That is, this federal government in the form of an extended republic. Finally, in conclusion, last night we heard from Professor Glendon about various criticisms of the Federalist view. But it is not only those who disagree with the Federalist view who have criticized or observed that there is a problem. And ultimately, that problem has to do with the preservation of virtue. Insofar as federalism is preserved and the states and local governments have autonomy, you have the nurturing ground for virtue. But more is required. What is required is education. And the Federalists did not ignore this altogether. At the very time that they were setting up this Constitution, in the very summer, the Congress passed the Northwest Ordinance, which we know provided for school. Richard Epstein would say the public schools, the government schools, but that's not what they provided for. They were providing for money for schools and, dare we say it, religion, because they linked the two together in the notion that only then, at the local level, could you promote virtue. Now, what are we to do today? Well, I would suggest, as Justice Scalia recommends, that law students and law professors in their first year constitutional law course acquaint their students with the Federalist Papers beyond simply 10, 51, and 78, and begin to understand a different way of thinking of this document, not as a parchment to be parsed by judges only, but as a living document, as the founders understood, lived through institutions manned by human beings, realizing interest and ambition, checking those against each other in order to produce the public good and ultimately justice. Thank you very much.
We will next hear from Professor Douglas Laycock of the University of Texas Law School. He has written broadly on constitutional issues. His particular cachet, however, is on religious liberty. I understand he's written a number of the briefs, submitted in important cases on that subject. I shan't ask him on which side he has been, whether he's been on the winning side. He's also written, for those of you interested in torts, he's written the definitive work on the death of irreparable injury rule. What relevance that may have to today's subject, he might tell us. Professor Laycock.
The answer to which side my briefs are on is easy. My briefs are on the side of liberty. We will get some controversy in this panel. I think the constitutional architecture of the Federalist Papers with respect to liberty was important, but partial, and its most conspicuous failure, not from the perspective of our time, but from the perspective of their time. It was immediately rejected as a failure. Constitutional architecture includes federalism, separation of powers, checks and balances, and what was not part of the Federalist Papers theory, judicially enforceable guarantees of individual liberty. That does not appear in the work of Publius because Publius was stuck with the proposal he had. He had to defend what came from the convention, and that did not contain what we now think of as the Bill of Rights. I do not want to be misunderstood. Separation of powers and checks and balances, certainly, and less certainly, but I think also federalism, are important protections for liberty. They are necessary protections for liberty, but they are not sufficient protections for liberty. And what I want to do is compare Hamilton in the Federalist Papers with Madison a year later on the floor of the First Congress on the addition of the Bill of Rights. The principal, indeed the only explicit response in the Federalist Papers to the charge that the Constitution lacks a Bill of Rights appears in paper 84. There were only 85, save for the very end. It is not the entire paper. 84 is offered as a brief discussion of, quote, miscellaneous points that did not naturally fall under any particular head or were forgotten in their proper places. If your argument on a point is weak, you say the point is not important. Hamilton has 3 points on the merits, or actually four, I guess. First, quite correctly, he says the Constitution does have a Bill of Rights, and he spends 3/4 of a page quoting the provisions. Limitations on the law of treason, on abuse of the impeachment power, habeas corpus, no bills of attainder, no ex post facto laws, no titles of nobility, local jury trial in criminal cases. To that list, I would add the Contract Clause, the Legal Tender Clause, and the Privileges and Immunities Clause in Article 4, and I assume he omitted them because they applied only to the states and did not constrain the federal government. Second, he says, a Bill of Rights is wholly inappropriate and does not belong in a constitution based on the sovereignty of the people. You will notice certain tension between points one and points two. We have a Bill of Rights, but we shouldn't. A Bill of Rights, he says, is a concession from a king to his subjects. The people have no need for a Bill of Rights against themselves. And here I'm quoting, here in strictness the people surrender nothing, and as they retain everything, they have no need of particular reservations. And if we take that argument seriously, they have also no need of federalism, separation of powers, checks and balances, or any of the rest of the protections against bad government. This argument contrasts sharply with everything that we have discussed for the last 2 days and for everything in the rest of the Federalist Papers. In number 10, Madison tells us that, that the majority faction violates the rights of citizens. In 48, he says legislatures have flagrantly and repeatedly violated the state constitutions and their bills of rights. And in 44, he says, not only do legislatures interfere with personal rights, but one legislative interference is but the first link in a long chain of repetitions, echoing the language of the Declaration of Independence about King George. But by 84, they're saying a Bill of Rights has no place in a system of representative government. Third, Hamilton says, and this is by far the most familiar of the Federalist arguments about the Bill of Rights, you certainly don't need a Bill of Rights in a government of limited powers. And the famous statement is often quoted, for why declare that things shall not be done which there is no power to do? Why, for instance, should it be said that the liberty of the press shall not be restrained when there is no power given by which restrictions may be imposed? So we don't need it. You need it in a state constitution, maybe, because they have plenary powers, but certainly not in, as against the federal government. And finally, his fourth point is, even if you had a Bill of Rights, it would be meaningless. And he's as eloquent as Lino Graglia in deriding and making fun of the language of Bills of Rights provisions. He says, a Bill of Rights would necessarily be so vague that only the legislature could interpret it, and therefore it would be useless. Who knows what liberty of the press means? And as an aside, I simply note that this passage is tough on original intent arguments. Hamilton, at least, had no original understanding of what a Bill of Rights provision might mean. He just didn't get it. Now, it's familiar history that these arguments were rejected. Several states attached demands for a Bill of Rights to their ratification provisions. North Carolina flatly refused to ratify until the Bill of Rights was added. It is less known, Madison himself had a very close call in the elections for the first Congress. Principally because of his continued doubts about the need for a religious liberty clause. And he told the good Baptists and Presbyterians in Virginia not to worry, there's no federal power to interfere with religion. And James Monroe, who was his opponent, said, don't rely on that, I'll give you a religious liberty clause. the Bill of Rights was promptly added in the first Congress and ratified within 2 years. And it seems to me clear from the history that the Bill of Rights is part of the original constitutional bargain and not merely an afterthought. As Judge Buckley said, their Constitution would not have been ratified without the promise of the addition of a Bill of Rights. Madison in the first Congress develops what seems to me the rest of our constitutional architecture about liberty. He introduced the Bill of Rights on June 8, 1789. He made a lengthy speech introducing it. And in my judgment, it is a speech that has not received nearly enough attention. He says Publius was wrong. By 1789, a year later, he has figured out, or he is at least now willing to explain in public, the connections between the risk of legislative abuse, the danger of faction, and the need for a Bill of Rights. He explicitly refutes Hamilton's second and third arguments. He implicitly rejects the fourth. And the first one you'll recall was that we already got part of a Bill of Rights, so that obviously required no refutation. Hamilton's second argument was you don't need a Bill of Rights where the people are sovereign, and Madison says to the contrary, where the people are sovereign, the people are the greatest danger, and the Bill of Rights must be directed against them. He says a Bill of Rights must be leveled against the legislative branch, for it is the most powerful, the most likely to be abused because it is under the least control, but even that's not the greatest danger. The great danger lies rather in the abuse of the community than in the abuse of the legislative body. the prescriptions in favor of liberty ought to be leveled against that quarter where the greatest danger lies, namely that which possesses the highest prerogative of power, and this is found in the body of the people operating by the majority against the minority. Hamilton's third argument was you don't need a Bill of Rights in a government of limited powers, and Madison rejects that too. Powers and rights, this is not quoting, powers and rights are not Hofeldian opposites. They are intersecting categories. He didn't have Hofeld to work with, but he put it in terms of ends and means. The ends of the federal government may be limited, but all necessary and proper means in pursuit of those ends are available, and some of those means may be abusive of rights. And he gives the example of the general government has a right to pass all laws which shall be necessary to collect its revenue. The means for enforcing the collection are within the direction of the legislature. May not general warrants be considered necessary for this purpose? So you don't have to have a specific clause that says you can issue general warrants or you can suppress the press. Other powers may give rise to applications that do those things, and that's why we need a Bill of Rights. Finally, Hamilton said a Bill of Rights doesn't mean anything, and Madison said they don't mean anything unless you provide a mechanism for enforcement. Separation of powers is a mere parchment barrier, he had said in Federalist 48, unless you have a mechanism to enforce separation of powers. And similarly, introducing the Bill of Rights, he says they're mere paper barriers unless you have a mechanism for enforcement. And for the federal Bill of Rights, the means of enforcement is to be judicial review. And in another famous phrase, he says, independent tribunals of justice will consider themselves in a peculiar manner the guardians of these rights. They will be naturally led to resist every encroachment upon these rights. It is judicial review that is to turn parchment barriers into an impenetrable bulwark. This is part of separation of powers. This is constitutional architecture. It is a check and balance that these independent judges will be specially charged with the interpretation and enforcement of these rights. Now, in addition to dealing with the three claims of Publius from the year before, Madison makes two other points of lasting importance in this speech. First, he saw that states as well as the federal government were threats to liberty. And he proposed to protect speech and religion, which he thought of as the most important of the Bill of Rights, to protect speech and religion even from state violations. And he said that proposal was the most important in the whole list of amendments. He lost. The country wasn't ready for federal rights against states beyond what had already been included in Article I, and that mistake does not get corrected until after the Civil War. Second, Madison says we can't enumerate all the rights, and the danger is if we list some, we'll lose the others. By enumerating particular exceptions to the grant of power, it might disparage those rights which were not placed in the enumeration, and the solution for that is the Ninth Amendment. It is an individual liberty and not a federalism explanation of the Ninth Amendment. Madison's explanation is that it means what it seems to mean. Now, I, again, don't want to be misunderstood. I do not defend everything the judiciary has ever done in the name of the Bill of Rights. There have been excesses. There have also been insufficiencies. I would enforce those provisions of the Bill of Rights that protect property as well as those that protect non-property liberties. I do reject the charge that judicial enforcement of the Bill of Rights was generally excessive or illegitimate in the civil rights era now, like civil liberties era that now may be ending, say roughly 1937 to 1987. Active judicial enforcement of the Bill of Rights was an intended part of our constitutional architecture. Three somewhat more general points. There is a tendency in the rhetoric of the majoritarian anti-judicial branch of the conservative movement to appeal simultaneously to the virtues of original intent and popular democracy. And it seems to me the passages I just read, a number of other things that people have quoted, indicate you can't have it both ways. The original intent was not enamored of popular democracy. It embraced only a very limited democracy, and part of the limitation was a Bill of Rights and judicial review. The founders view legislatures as a far better protection of liberty than a king, but even so, those legislatures themselves were a threat to liberty, and at least Madison saw further and saw that the majority of the people were the greatest threat to liberty. Last night's speakers also talked about the seeming schizophrenia in the Federalist view of human nature, and I have two observations about that. The framers were on, they're both variations at this point. It was possible to have schizophrenic thoughts about human nature because in some ways they had the same group of people subdivided, were thinking about them in two different ways. They were on the cusp of a great transition from royal to popular government, and the differing views of human nature were possible in part because sometimes they thought of government as the people, the ones to be protected, and then other times they thought of government as the government, an alien force, something like the crown. And they did not always keep straight, even in their own minds, which threats to liberty carried over from royal government to popular government and in what form they carried over. A couple of obvious examples. Popular government is a very good protection against some royal abuses, say excessive taxation, very little protection against others, say suppression of highly unpopular speakers or aggressive new proselytizing religions. The jury was a great protection against royal abuse of the majority's rights, and the jury figures prominently in our Bill of Rights, but juries turn out to be almost worthless for protecting political minorities against political majorities. An armed population is a great protection against royal or dictatorial abuse. It is quite unlikely to protect against popular government because the people with the majority of the guns are also the people with the majority of the votes. So an armed population is much more likely to empower criminals and political extremists against popular government. Secondly, the schizophrenia was facilitated by thinking about different levels of government. The Bill of Rights was directed against the federal government, a new entity, unfamiliar and threatening. The Federalists saw clearly the dangers of state governments and had difficulty seeing the dangers of the federal government, and the Anti-Federalists were the opposite. The Anti-Federalists couldn't see the dangers of state government, but they were immensely clear what were the dangers of the federal government, and from that clarity of vision with respect to this outside threat, we get the Bill of Rights. And the Reconstruction Amendments are similar. It was then clear that at least some states, the southern states, were a great threat to liberty, and the northern states saw that with great clarity, and enacted provisions to bind the states, not thinking about themselves, thinking about southern abuses. And so once again, we got clarity of vision only with respect to outsiders. But from these two episodes of clear vision about the dangers of other governments, we got essential protections for all of us against all of our levels of government, both state and federal and throughout the nation.
Thank you, Professor. Our final speaker is Professor Jeffrey Miller of the University of Chicago Law School, a man of very broad interests extending economics, business law, and the Constitution, especially with respect to the separation of powers. Professor Miller. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. John, I was very interested in your observation that the Federalist Papers are now bestsellers in Eastern Europe. This might, I think, be a measure of the fact that had the insights of Madison, Hamilton, and Jay been respected in 1918, the dark tragedy of the Soviet Empire would never have happened. After all, anybody who took seriously the great insights of the Federalist Papers could have predicted the sorry outcome of the communist experiment from the start. The great insight of the Federalists, or one of them, was, after all, that all power is encroaching, and if left unchecked, it would lodge in a single hand, which is the very essence of tyranny. And what is communism in practice but the accumulation of all power in a single hand? Farsighted observers understood this point from the very start of the communist idea. I quote one observer, the anarchist Bakunin, writing in 1868. Bakunin says, "I am not a communist. Because communism calls for all power to be lodged in the state, which is everywhere debased, enslaved, and oppressed the people." He may have been quirky on some of his views, but he was right on the money about that one. That brings me to the topic of this panel, liberty and constitutional architecture. It may sound a bit vague and abstract, but I think it's actually quite significant that the organizers of this conference have chosen to link these two concepts of liberty and constitutional architecture together. Not long ago, that linkage would have seemed unfamiliar, strange, perhaps a bit odd, because the connection between liberty and constitutional architecture wasn't clear-cut. The fact that they are now linked, both in this panel and in some recent scholarship, is perhaps a sign that we may be nearing a point of synthesis in which liberty and architecture, or another synonymous phrase perhaps, rights and structure, are brought together and seen in terms of the close historical and functional connections between them. Such a development I think, be a real advance in our thinking if it could be achieved, and I want to explain why this might be so. Until quite recently, as Professor Baker mentioned, the debate over constitutional law has been dominated by the question of which rights or classes should receive special constitutional protections available under the Bill of Rights or the Reconstruction Amendments. These were not the issues, however, which most deeply concerned the framers of the Constitution. The framers were overwhelmingly concerned with matters of structure, separation of power, and federalism. Separation of power and federalism are the fundamental matrix, or Euclidean plane, if you will, of our constitutional law. And these issues dominated the minds of the framers at least as fully and completely as questions of individual rights dominate contemporary constitutional thought. This is not to say that questions of individual rights were unimportant to the framers of the original document, or that structural issues have been completely absent from contemporary constitutional discourse. That would overstate the case. But it is true that structural issues were the dominant theme of the founding period, and that questions of rights are the dominant theme of the modern era. As the topic of this panel illustrates, the primacy of rights is now coming under increased scrutiny. We would like to know something about the following question. What is the proper relationship in modern constitutional law and constitutional theory between the two great systems of fundamental law, the system of rights, including individual rights and economic liberties, and the system of structure, including separation of powers and federalism? For these systems obviously do not operate in hermetically sealed compartments. We should expect, on the contrary, that any fully satisfactory theory of constitutional law would offer insights about the relation between structure and rights, as well as, more fundamentally, provide an account that explains, justifies, and articulates both systems. A basic challenge of modern constitutional law, in other words, is to develop something like a grand unified theory that would explain both the system of rights and that of structure as manifestations of deeper underlying principles. The challenge is, of course, enormously daunting, and not one that can even be remotely handled in a single major piece of scholarship, much less the proverbial few minutes allotted by the overseers in this conference. Indeed, it may be impossible to accomplish the challenge at all. But in the brief time I have, I want to suggest, albeit in extremely sketchy fashion, some of the broad elements that ought perhaps to be included in any grand unified theory if one is eventually developed. The first element is that of cross-fertilization. Once a system of rights and that of structure are no longer seen as hermetically sealed compartments, it would seem obvious that principles which you derive under the system of rights ought to be applicable, or at least have some bearing, on questions that arise under the system of structure. Conversely, principles arising under the system of structure ought to inform at some level our understanding of rights. This is cross-fertilization from one system to the other. Lest this principle of cross-fertilization seem too abstract, let me try to bring the analysis down to earth a little with an example. Consider the case of Morrison versus Olson, where the Supreme Court upheld the independent counsel statute against the challenge that it violated the separation of powers principle. Now, if the rights structure perspective is brought to bear on that decision, it might provide a somewhat different way of looking at the issues. In practice, a court or constitutional theorist, or in particular, a court or constitutional theorist, would look at the independent counsel statute in terms of the bearing it might have on individual liberty, which is the fundamental value directly served by the system of rights. And when the liberty of the individual is concerned, we are led to ask questions not considered by the Supreme Court in the Morrison opinion. For example, are special prosecutors more likely to intrude on individual liberty interests because they have a single mandate to investigate and, if necessary, prosecute the targeted government official? Or is a special prosecutor more likely to intrude on individual liberty interests because his or her own prestige is tied up in the inevitable conflict with the target of the investigation or with the success of the prosecution? To ask these questions is virtually to answer them. Special prosecutors do have incentives which are more likely to result in intrusions on individual liberty than are the incentives of career officials. I think we have seen this danger, unfortunately, come to pass more than once in the sordid course of the independent counsel legislation. Thus, the right structure perspective suggests additional reasons to question the constitutionality of the independent counsel statute beyond those considered and rejected by the Supreme Court in Morrison case. Now, so far I've talked about cross-fertilization in one way only, that is, from the system of rights into the system of structure. Cross-fertilization can work the other way as well. Concepts can be taken from the system of structure and applied to questions arising under the system of rights. Now, as the principle we draw from the system of rights is that of liberty, I think the principle that we can draw from the system of structure is that of checks and balances, as articulated with wonderful brilliance by Madison in the Federalist Papers. As is well known, has been mentioned already at this conference, Madison was very suspicious of parchment barriers. Parchment barriers, Madison might have said, are not worth the parchment that they're written on. And it is this distrust of parchment barriers that leads the Federalist in number 51 to set up the system of checks and balances, power countering power, ambition countering ambition. All this seems consistent, sensible, and logical. But the theory encounters a real difficulty, to say the least, when it runs up against the Bill of Rights, which was enacted so close to the founding period as to be part of the same constitutional moment, if you'll pardon an allusion to a scholar not ordinarily associated with the Federalist cause. What do we confront when we look at the Bill of Rights? Nothing other than a set of parchment barriers. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech and so on. But it is deafeningly silent as to who, if anyone, is going to stop Congress from making such a law if it wants to. The same goes for the other principles of the Bill of Rights. Thus we face a puzzle, an original document whose authoritative justification denigrates parchment barriers as all but useless, and a set of nearly contemporaneous amendments that appear to erect exactly the type of parchment barriers rejected by the original framers. How do we overcome this difficulty? One possibility, I think holding some promise, is to import the principle of checks and balances into the provisions of the Bill of Rights, to engage, in other words, in cross-fertilization under the rights structure paradigm. When the principle checks and balances is applied to the Bill of Rights, it becomes apparent that the first 10 amendments can and should be viewed not so much as a restriction on the power of the federal government, although they are that, but rather as a grant of power to the Supreme Court vis-a-vis the other branches. The court was, after all, the only institution of government equipped to enforce these rights reliably. And the Bill of Rights, after all, were drawn up in the form, similar to a Bill of Particulars, of the sort with which judges were familiar in their day-to-day roles. In this respect, I think, the Bill of Rights can be seen as remedying a defect in the original Constitution, which had established two relatively strong branches of government, Congress and the President, but failed to give equal powers to the judicial branch. Arguably, the Bill of Rights should be seen as giving the judiciary greater powers, more consonant with its equal dignity in the constitutional structure through the device of judicial review. Thus, the right structure perspective can be seen as providing a somewhat subtle argument for the legitimacy and authoritativeness of judicial review. Well, we've talked about cross-fertilization, importing concepts across the rights structure divide. I want to close by addressing the broader possibility of connecting rights and structure, namely bringing both rights and structure together under some overarching set of concepts that unifies both. And to do this, to unite rights and structure, I think it's useful to consider the Federalist Papers, I'm sure this will come as a surprise to everyone in the audience, as setting forth the basic equation or formula of government design. The Federalist Papers pose the problem of government, or one can see them as posing the problem of government, in terms of two costs. On the one hand, there is the cost of private expropriation, violence, and oppression. It is this cost, indeed, which necessitates the creation of government in the first place. If men were angels, the Federalist Papers tell us, there would be no need for government. but the establishment of government itself as a way of coping with this first cost of private expropriation and violence itself is accompanied by a cost, and that is the cost of government expropriation, violence, and oppression. Thus, the Federalist Papers sets up a principle of optimal government design. The principle is this. The optimal design for government is that which minimizes the sum of two costs, the cost of private expropriation, violence, and oppression on the one hand, and the cost of government expropriation, violence, and oppression on the other. How does the Federalist Paper carry out this analysis? It does, I think, through the use of two key concepts. The first is that of energy, which is mentioned by Professor David Epstein. We are repeatedly told in the Federalist Papers that the government to be established by the Constitution must be energetic. And it is crystal clear from the Federalist Papers that the reason for energy in government is the need to cope with this first cost, the cost of private expropriation and violence. Only an energetic government, the Federalist Papers tells us, can suppress insurrections and private violence and repel foreign invasions. The second key concept in the Federalist Papers, as it bears on the rights structure equation, is that of avoiding faction. Government should be designed so as to minimize the threat of faction. Either a minority faction oppressing a majority, as happened for over 70 years in the former Soviet Union, or a majority faction oppressing a minority, as unfortunately threatens to happen now in some of the lands newly freed from the criminal clique of the Soviet Communist Party. I took a look at the Federalist Papers, the words they use to describe faction, and they include the following. Violence, instability, injustice, confusion, distress, misfortune, distrust, alarm, unsteadiness, mischief, animosity, opprobrium, danger, turbulence, contention, prejudice, intrigue, corruption, dread, conflagration, rage, malady, taint, disease, and so on. It's hard to come up with more synonyms than that for something terrible. It was clear that the Federalist Papers are not high on faction. Now, the concepts of energy in government, on the one hand, and avoidance of faction, on the other, are at a very high level of generality. And one might say that they provide little of substance in the analysis of particular constitutional issues. And this may well be true, but I think the concepts are important nonetheless because they frame the analysis of particular questions in a way that might provide some insights into actual cases. And I want to use as my closing example the case of constitutional criminal procedure. During the Warren Court years, the Supreme Court analyzed the rights of criminal suspects as presenting a trade-off. And the trade-off was between the suspect's constitutionally protected interest in liberty, on the one hand, and the practical interest of criminal law enforcement, on the other. And when the problem is phrased in this light, I think it becomes very easy to make the trade-off in all marginal cases in favor of the constitutionally sanctioned rights of the accused. After all, we're balancing a constitutional right against a mere interest. The right usually trumps. Hence the Warren Court's extremely liberal agenda on criminal procedure issues. But consider what happens to the, under the perspective that unites rights and structure. For now we see that the concept of energy in government, that is, the energy necessary to stop private expropriation and violence, that concept has a constitutional dimension. Thus, in the case of criminal law enforcement, it is not the case that a constitutional right of the accused is balanced against a non-constitutional right of the, or interest, rather, of the government in law enforcement. The criminal law enforcement function is itself an expression of energy in government. The job of the government to stop private expropriation and violence, and therefore, the interest in criminal enforcement also has a constitutional dimension. When both rights of the accused and rights of the state in criminal law enforcement have a constitutional dimension, the analysis of particular issues in the area of constitutional criminal procedure might well come out differently, and in some cases, less favorably to the accused. The Supreme Court today appears implicitly to be adopting such a perspective in many of its criminal law opinions, but it has yet to apply the conceptual rationale suggested here to justify its results. As promised, I won't go into other implications of the right structure perspective, on constitutional law, although there are many other interesting implications. Instead, I'll rest content to say that the development of some kind of unified theory of constitutional law ought, in my opinion, to be a major challenge of constitutional thinkers in the coming years. And more generally, it is through this type of rethinking of our fundamental law that we can keep the mirror of our self-concept as a political society polished and free of dust, and to maintain the lived reality of ordered liberty to pass on as a precious heritage to the next generation. Thank you.
I wonder if the house lights could come on now. In order to provide adequate time for questions from the audience, I thought we'd change the schedule just a little bit and invite our panelists to be rather expansive in their answers and interrupt one another, rather than asking them at the outset to challenge some of the statements that have been made thus far. Do we have the lights, please? They're on? I'm afraid I can't see who might be lined up behind microphones. Okay.
I have a question specifically for Professor Laycock, but I'd be curious what the other responses would be. How would Hamilton and Madison perhaps disagreed, or would they have agreed in the decision in Lochner? And I'd be curious to know what kind of response you would have to Holmes's argument that basically the constitutional architecture has failed to prevent the politics of the majority from deciding constitutional interpretation.
You have time for a book? What that question raises is the whole problem of how you distinguish legitimate from illegitimate interpretations of the Bill of Rights. And part of the objection to active judicial enforcement is the fear that we can't distinguish, and that judges will just turn out to be as political as everybody else. In part, that is a problem not soluble in the short run. It's soluble in the long run because the judges are appointed through a political process in which the people are represented. I think there are some things that can be said about it even in the short run, and simply to sketch where that goes. Yeah, I think a lot more attention to constitutional text than is fashionable will help eliminate whole areas of doctrine that don't make a whole lot of sense or don't have a whole lot of basis in the Constitution. With particular reference to Lochner, I take the economic rights in the Constitution very seriously, but I don't think you can plausibly read a right to laissez-faire freedom of contract into a Constitution that contains an express power to regulate commerce. So I think that Lochner was wrong textually, demonstrably so. I got a whole theory, but you don't want to hear it today.
So I have a question for either Professor Miller or Laycock. You both mentioned about the legislature being less of a guarantor of liberty than the judicial branch. It's rather ironic to think that would be the case, since the legislature can be voted out of it. Of course, judges, at least the federal level, are appointed for life. So that's the basic question, is who judges the judges?
Well, part of the people who judge the judges are us, I think. In this kind of process of reinventing our traditions and reaffirming our traditions and reviewing our traditions, we think about what contributions the judges have made to our traditions, and whether we agree with them or not. I think there's a large process of debate that goes on outside of the process of judicial opinions, which is itself, in my opinion, part of the Constitution in a broad sense. And eventually, if the ideas are strong enough, if the repudiation of what judges have done becomes widespread enough, we're going to get different judges, and the process of the constitutional law will change. It's happened many times in the past. It may be happening now with the Reagan judges. So I think we, the people, judge the judges, and it seems to me that the Constitution has done a pretty good job at allowing that to happen.
There's no guarantee that judges will be better than anybody else. I certainly don't believe that. For much of our history, they haven't been. At the moment, the Supreme Court may be worse than any other branch of government. But there are some benefits to the tradition. Sometimes you can generate what Madison predicted, that these people will take a special responsibility for individual liberty. But the only really structural difference is this. I think it's an important one. It's easier to overlook. The one thing you do get from the judiciary is that they are at least obliged to listen to every claimant and to decide that case. And some of the time, some of the judges, maybe a lot of the time a lot of the judges, but that's only maybe, will make a good faith effort to actually decide that case. There's no guarantee that the legislature even has to listen. The legislature does not have to deal with every problem brought before it. The judiciary does, and what the Bill of Rights does is to provide a forum in which to argue about those particular freedoms that our legal ancestors thought were sufficiently important to give special constitutional protection. That's the most you can say.
I think it's a mistake to focus just on the judiciary, even in criticizing what judges are doing. That is, it's a question, again, of structure and of looking at all three branches. It's not merely the judicial supremacists who give too much attention to the judiciary. The critics give too much attention to the judiciary. If you understand the structure, the fault has to be laid at the feet of the executive and the Congress just as well. In fact, probably more so than the Congress. And in a really strange way, I think that what has happened, especially with what the Congress does, vindicates the view of Publius that the Congress will tend to dominate. What do I mean? The judiciary is, by and large, in my view, failing to hold the Congress to what it's supposed to do, that is, exercise its legislative powers. So that, just to take a recent example, the American Disabilities Act, in order to pass the legislation, they settle on a term, reasonable accommodation. They don't define it, and they kick it to the federal courts. Why? They don't want to take the political heat for it. They don't want to be responsive to the electorate. I would say that the fault of the judiciary in that context is letting the Congress use the judiciary. They are not adequately defending the judiciary against a strange kind of incursion, which is dumping the blame on the judiciary. Now, it has gone to the heads of some judges that since the Congress won't govern, we must do it. But Justice Scalia has pointed out that what is happening is that the judiciary is becoming a bureaucratic agency. And to the extent that that happens, you are reducing the power and the prestige of federal judges. Justice Scalia has made that speech several times. And we are turning the federal judiciary in this country into some kind of civil law judiciary where they're clerks and functionaries. Look at all the administrative matters that come into the federal judiciary. And that's why district judges have to have not only law clerks, but magistrates and everything else. Now, this may look like it is creating great power for the judiciary in the short term. But in the long term, I think it is drowning the judiciary.
Question over there. Professor Lightcock, I believe, gave an explanation of the Ninth Amendment that it was intended to incorporate anything that wasn't listed. I'd like to hear the definition of the other two panelists as to what the Ninth Amendment means.
Well, it seems to me I think it means pretty much what it says. It's designed to refute the negative inferences that you might draw from the fact that certain rights are expressed in the Bill of Rights. That those are the only rights that are available. I mean, I would tend to take it pretty much at face value, and it seems to me it fulfills a pretty good function in that sense. I don't see it as the source, independently of substantive rights, that you could draw only out of the Ninth Amendment. seems to me only to refute an inference that you might draw from the fact that a Bill of Rights had been adopted.
I'd like to elaborate on that. I would agree with Professor Laycock that certainly when we're looking at the Bill of Rights, the issue ultimately is the enforcement mechanism, and that is the legitimacy of judicial review. There is another factor in understanding the Bill of Rights and also in the Ninth Amendment, and that is that they are operating against the background of the common law. And law students are taught today that the common law is merely judge-made law. Well, that may be what it has become, but that is not what the founding generation understood the common law to be. The common law was made law, but it was not designed law. It was organic law, and it was not the product of a particular sovereign. And if you understand that background, it is not at all peculiar that the Bill of Rights did not provide particular remedies. It has been fairly well established by those who have looked at it historically that the anticipation, for instance, on the Fourth Amendment was that it would be enforced by common law suits on trespass as well as criminal actions for burglary where appropriate. So to the extent that the positivism of the Erie Doctrine has prevailed, it has distorted our understanding of the founding generation. And that's another whole topic to discuss. And as a result, you get what was referred to by Professor Laycock as this judicial conservatives who don't trust judicial review because it's anti-democratic. Well, it's not anti-democratic as democracy is defined in the Federalist Papers, which is written against the background of the common law, which accepts the notion that there is the rule of law and that the rule of law is over each element of the government, and that you do not equate what judges say about the Constitution with the Constitution itself. They could distinguish those kinds of things that are very difficult for us to do today.
That's a late comment.
I don't disagree with much of that.
Hi. What all thought as American lawyers that these architectural guarantees of liberty, the federal structure of government, the separate judiciary, the separation of the executive from the legislative, and a bicameral legislature that has equal branches, are very important guarantees. And yet when one looks at the wider free world, one sees that although some of the larger countries are federal, and an independent judiciary is in almost all of them, there is very little separation of the executive from the legislative, and almost no effective, strong, equal bicameral legislatures. What I'm interested in hearing is whether the members of the panel think that this means that these countries are more oppressive than ours, or that the founders' estimation of the relative importance of these structural guarantees was just wrong, or whether perhaps a point that was touched upon last night, that the framers had a very negative view of human nature, that human nature was not perfectible, might have to be modified at least a little bit to say that the mentalities of large groups of people can change over time, and that the mentality toward freedom has changed in the rest of the world, and that this change has preceded free government rather than has been produced by the architecture of the various governments elsewhere in the world.
What you're asking is what advice Professor Baker has been giving people in Eastern Europe.
I think there are at least four questions in there. First of all, you have to understand that those at the convention understood that it was possible, given years of history, as you had in England, to protect liberty in other ways. Their problem was they were dealing with a short fuse, not as short as Eastern Europe, but a short one relative to England. And the question was, how could they produce a civilized government somewhat similar to England without the history? So they substitute by design institutions to produce the same kind of result. Now, for the last 30 or 40 years, our State Department has been telling countries around the world that they ought not to follow our system, that they ought to follow a parliamentary system. There are a lot of basket cases around the world, and I would suggest that part of it may have to do with that advice. as to whether it is possible or not to have a free system with a parliamentary system, I think that the judgment in each case is tied to that particular country. If this was going to be a nation that wasn't resting on one particular religious, ethnic, or racial group, then there had to be a way of working out those factions. The inability to do that in Eastern Europe is a major problem. So whether they use our system or not, they've got to come up with some kind of mechanism. Ours was a mechanism designed to deal with a common problem to all democratic governments. Whether or not another country uses the same kind of mechanism depends on many circumstances. But I can tell you that the problems in Eastern Europe are essentially, in terms of faction, no different than the problems that we have faced.
I might just add to that, I think you asked a very interesting question, that I think Professor Becker is right about the history point, that in England, which was obviously our prime example for our constitution, there was a long history of constitutional arrangements which, even if not written down in the form of a constitution, were served the same function. We didn't have that in the United States nearly to the same extent. In addition, I think one should add the fact that the future of our young republic was quite different than the future that could be predicted for the existing European countries. We had, after all, a thin slice of population on the eastern seaboard. We had vast undeveloped lands. We had a country that had very little self-defense. Its foreign relations were uncertain. And it's not only that we could look confidently to the past and say we have an established structure of institutions, but we could not look confidently to the future and say that we're going to have an established structure of institutions without some explicit safeguards written into the document. Now, of course, it's been 200 years now since that time, and now we have a past that we can look back on, and we have a future, I think, which is much more secure than it was in 1787. Does that suggest that now we can dispense with these unnecessary and complex ramifications of the Constitution, which, after all, in Europe didn't seem to be that important? And I think it's not insignificant that in the last 20, 30, 40 years, there's been a lot more interest in the parliamentary system and a lot more complaints about these annoying impediments and checks and balances that stop effective government. I personally would be dubious about that, partly because I think that part of our history that we now have and that we've developed over the past 200 years is the separation of the executive and the legislative branch and between the bicameralism principle, so that we can't really abandon that without abandoning the history which is now part of our Constitution.
Very briefly, no set of mechanisms will work to protect liberty unless there's sufficient support among the people for it. So the answer to the very end of your question is in part, yes, you gotta have that view among the people, and you've got it sufficiently in Western Europe that they get substantial protections with money. With much less elaborate mechanisms, although some of them do have judicial review. But the other half of that is that our separation of power isn't nearly as strong as we make it out to be. The administrative agencies are our biggest mechanism for getting rid of it. But you know, also the electoral, the distinctions among the electoral bases are much less in an age of mass media and with direct election of senators and with the electoral college viewed largely as a formality. And even the judges, as I mentioned, are ultimately selected through political processes that start with the same voters who vote for the president and for the Senate. So it's easy to exaggerate the extent of the differences, and it's not surprising that in relatively similar societies you get relatively similar solutions to some of these problems of individual liberty, even though you got different mechanisms. But John says, there are lots of societies where you still find the most terrible oppression of religious minorities, ethnic minorities, various sorts of political minorities. Some sort of mechanism is needed, as well as some sort of belief in the values of liberty among the people and the governors.
Thank you. This question is primarily directed to Professor Miller, but if any of the other panelists would like to comment, that would be fine. You've presented a interesting defense of the judiciary's use of the implicit check of judicial review to enforce individual liberties. I'm interested in your commenting on the judiciary's use of that check of judicial review to enforce separation of powers. And I'd suggest that since 1937, They've done a very poor job of that. And we might dismiss some of their failings as, well, that was a crazy time way back then before we were born, or at least I was born. Just looking at the decisions of the last decade, you have a rather mixed view. I mean, Chadha's a very good decision, but your example of Morrison v. Olson points out a situation when really all three branches of government sort of colluded to, at least the majority of the Supreme Court, come up with some rather scandalous excuses for why this didn't violate separation of powers. So I'm wondering if you can suggest whether we should be optimistic or whether there are any checks or structural impediments that would keep the court from, or promote the court to enforce separation of power?
Well, it's a fascinating question. It's true that whenever the court, the Supreme Court, issues any opinion, but certainly whenever it issues an opinion rejecting a federal statute on the ground that it's unconstitutional, the Supreme Court's opinion is not just an opinion on the merits of the case. It is also a significant statement about the relationship between the Supreme Court and the other branches. Because after all, when the Supreme Court tells Congress that it can't do something, or the President that he or she can't do something, that's a significant statement and assertion of authority by the Supreme Court. Now, it becomes even more complicated when the Supreme Court is dealing with a case that specifically arises the issue of separation of powers, because there the Supreme Court is not only asserting its power to adjudicate the dispute, but its own interests are often very profoundly in issue, particularly when the question of separation of powers involves the turf or jurisdiction of the Supreme Court itself. I'm not certain that I'm as pessimistic as you are, Todd, about the course of the Supreme Court's separation of powers jurisprudence, because there has been a significant increase in attention paid by the judiciary to issues of separation of powers. Some questions which would not have been even considered plausible 20 years ago are now at least in the domain of permissible arguments. And I think the court has done a sort of decently bad job compared to the indecently bad job that it does in many other issues in dealing with separation of powers issues. And I also think that I may be somewhat less concerned about the role of judicial review in separation of powers, because after all, that was something that the framers of the original document understood, knew about, and I think they viewed the separation of powers as being enforced not only by the judiciary, but also by the political give and take between Congress and the President and between the two branches of Congress. So it seems to me that the system is not terrible, it's merely sort of bad, but that's par for the course.
Does that suggest that there's a reason to expect that the Supreme Court would enforce the separation between Congress and the President as in Chadha or bicameralism, but not when its own powers are implicated?
Well, I think that the court has got to be specially careful when involving itself in a dispute where its own powers are at stake. It seems to me actually that it has been especially careful in that regard. Surprisingly, perhaps, it doesn't seem to want to expand its turf as much as it could with a jurisprudence under Article 3 of the Constitution and so on. But I think that all of us, in our role of checking the judiciary, ought to make sure that it doesn't expand its turf unnecessarily. I think that the standing area, for example, is a grotesque turf expansion by the courts, and something that ought to be carefully thought through.
We have another question?
No, I suggested before that what the judiciary is not doing really is protecting its own turf in certain areas. That separation of powers as enforced by the judiciary ought largely to be defensive, fending itself off from other branches. When you get to a case like Chadha, even though you may like the result in terms of separation of powers, the problem is that the procedure that brought the case to the court violated separation of powers. There was no case or controversy by the time the case went to the court. The case should never have been heard. The court wanted to get to the case, and what was it doing? It was not a defensive action. It was merely separating powers among the other two branches. When it does that, it tends to elevate itself above the other two branches rather than playing on the equal plane.
Thank you.
It seems doubtful to me that at the time of the drafting of the Constitution, that anyone could have anticipated the awesome power which has come to rest in administrative agencies. And especially this seems pertinent in post-Chevron era. And I was interested in Professor Macy's insight that this is especially dangerous because it reduces the costs of lawmaking and therefore encourages people to make more laws and all of these other things. But along those lines, I'm curious, now that we're in this situation, and now that the separation of powers has been, it seems, radically set off kilter, how do we get back? And what would the Federalists say?
Well, I mean, we are not on the route to getting back, so far as I can tell. If you want to get back, I think you need five heroic men or women on the Supreme Court to say, we ain't going to let you do it this way anymore. Everything this agency does is void, and courts will not enforce it. And short of that, there is no institutional mechanism pushing back the other way. But you know, with all respect to this society, the push for judges who ain't going to do anything important is precisely a push in the opposite direction from judges who will shut down the administration state. Got to pick your agendas.
Well,
on this
If not, we still have a few minutes. We started a little late. I'll allow each of the participants to leave a trenchant message or to deliver a trenchant riposte to what they have heard thus far.
I'd like to say to Doug Laycock, I think you got it kind of right, but maybe wrong too. And you said that the Bill of Rights is sort of a necessary supplement to the Constitution. But I don't think it's a necessary supplement to the original Constitution, maybe quite for the reasons that you said. It seems to me it's a necessary supplement because the original Constitution had a defective structural design, not because we actually needed a set of express limitations on the power of government, but that the Supreme Court was not powerful enough in the system of the original government. And I wondered what you thought of that maybe possible critique of your point.
Well, I guess I'm not entirely sure that it's that the critique is a different point or simply a different way of putting the same point. That is, I think your formulation of it and mine were really quite consistent. What made the court more powerful was not an amendment to Article 3 that said we confer the following additional powers on the court. It was a list of specific provisions about rights, which then turned out to be enforced by the court because, I think correctly, we found the Constitution itself to be judicially enforceable. So the source of power came from the addition of rights. I think the logic of putting those rights is I think we're extraordinarily lucky that we got more or less the right set of rights put in the Constitution. If you look at the experience of many state constitutions, badly drafted to start with and they have to be continuously amended, we're up into the 300s in the amendments to the Texas Constitution. we got basically the right set, and the right set in this sense, that either they are protections of individuals in situations where they're isolated and powerless, like a criminal defendant, against large powers that can potentially be abused, or they are protections of things that, for the most part and on average, are of unusual importance to the individual, and to which other forces in society may be unusually tempted to intrude unnecessarily and with excessive cost to the individual, like speech, like the privacy of the home in the Fourth Amendment, without getting into the debate over other kinds of privacy issues, like religion. So it wasn't just that any addition to the Supreme Court's power would have done, it was that these were, by and large, the right additions, it seems to me. But I quite agree that it was a defect in the original constitutional architecture and that it got fixed at the beginning.
In talking about the argument in the Federalist against the Bill of Rights, Professor Laycock said there was a conflict between the argument that this Constitution has certain provisions in it which are in the nature of rights, and then to argue that we don't need a Bill of Rights. There isn't a conflict at all. The point was that the body of the Constitution was a Bill of Rights, and that particular rights inserted into the whole and integrated into it were fine. What they objected to was the separation, the separate statement of rights, which was traditionally done at the beginning of a state constitution, because they thought it tended to divert people's attention from really what was the protection of their liberty, and it tended to get one into abstract philosophic debates. And the point today is not that the Bill of Rights isn't important. It is important. It has become part of our structures. It reflects our tradition, both the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist. It is a question of distortion. That is, it's not merely the Bill of Rights that protects our liberty. It is the entire structure that protects our liberty. And to give undue emphasis to the Bill of Rights or the judiciary without looking at the other components of structure is to ultimately fail to adequately protect liberty.
If I'm able to summarize what three panelists have told us today, is that because the architecture of the Constitution has placed effective restraints on the abuse of governmental power, the Bill of Rights has proven an effective instrument for the protection of our liberties. Thank you very much.